Welcome, everyone, to our Thursday night Stargate Roundtable. We're happy to have all of you with us here, and we're looking forward to an interesting evening. We have a guest the second hour, and this first hour we will open with Angel Sue setting the tone and getting us started with some good energy. So, Angel Sue, I pass the talking stick to you.
Thank you so much. And we welcome all of you in the light of the most radiant one in the office of the Christ and only in the office of the Christ. And we're invoking the loving energies of Saint Germain and the Violet Flame to just go everywhere within, around, and upon this planet. So if you will claim yourself once again as the divine child that you are, ever young, ever beautiful, ever perfect, and call in your support team, your higher self, your beloved twin flame, your guides, your masters, your teachers, your angels, your councils of light, and all those from the lighted realms that support you, and celebrate what you're doing here, just being here. And, you know, we celebrate all these beautiful ones with us. And so we're just going to take in a big, deep breath and release it when we're ready. And anchor in to the very core of Mother Earth. A beautiful cobalt blue sun that exists down there. And with another breath, we're going to call in a calibration from the great central sun that will balance, add, and help release whatever we need to release at this time. So as this shoots into us, we just send it right down into that beautiful blue sun. And we ask Mother Earth to send her blessings back up to us, and she regenerates us with the energy that just flows right into each shoulder blade as if they are your wings of energy, of light, of blessing. Now let's swirl all this energy as we praise, respect, thank, and love every aspect of it. Swirl it however you wish. Make it a vortex if you want to. And let all the colors, all the vibrations, all the blessings, all the balancing, all the release continue on. And now in this beautiful pillar of light that you've created around you, just intend that what you need for the next period of time, whatever is your best timing, that this continue on in an aspect of being perfected by the masters, by the angels. Ever more beautiful, that you find the perfect, happy solution to everything that comes in your path. And now as we're intending this blessing for ourselves, let's think about all those that we claim, our family, our friends, our associates. And as this perfect balance is happening within us, we're asking under the law of one, for the highest good for them also. Every issue that we're aware of, every situation. And let this beautiful light happen for them as well. For our planet, for Nasara, Nasara, the Reformation Act, for our faction, Three White Knights, for our galactic forces of light, for all those that are bringing forth these wonderful changes upon our planet to bring forth heaven now. And so with this, we're calling for their light, their calibration, their understanding of who they really are. Precious, divine, treasured. Whatever hat they're wearing, whether it's the white hat or a black hat, we're calling for that perfect divine neutrality. That all challenges, all situations that we and the others that are here with us as we're claiming this oneness, that it all finds that perfect, happy, divine solution. And so with this in mind and even better blessings than we can imagine, we're going to call in the law of one, the perfect original law of creation, and all other laws in all other dimensions are subject to this as well. So we're doing that time-space. We're asking for the parallels, the potentials, the past, present, future, all this timeline to be brought into this blessing and perfection. And we call all these beings associated with ourselves and every aspect of this world. We welcome them. We bless them. We accept them. We cherish them for all that they add, the options for growth. And we say we are all one. And as one is harmed, then all are harmed. As one is helped, then all are helped. And therefore, in the name of who we are, and we are one with all there is, we ask that only the highest good of all concerned to happen here. Lift this up. We call the masters and the angels to keep this going. 24/7, ever more beautiful, ever more astounding. And with this, we say thank you with grateful hearts. And we're going to close now by saying, yes, 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 do a good job. We love you. And we are all one. And when one is harmed, all are harmed. So we're calling in the best and highest healing here. And we'll say all men, all women, all children, all beings, all creation, we are all one. And with this, I say thank you. I pass that talking stick back.
Well, thank you, Angel Sue. It is such a joy to hear your vibrant voice and that you're feeling better. And we are grateful that you have had the opportunity to just come back to more what we have known as our Angel Sue. So thank you for being there and for opening the call tonight. We are grateful to the universe for your healing. And now I pass the talking stick to Caroline, who will help us understand the energies that are present this week in the Mayan calendar. We have always some interesting things, and of course we do have a new moon next week, so right in the middle of the week we'll look to see how that coordinates with what she has to share with us.
Okay, I'll take that talking stick. Thank you, Marita. And is that new moon on Tuesday or Wednesday? Do you know?
It's on Wednesday.
Okay, Wednesday. Yay. Oh, that's a good day. That's a portal day. So
okay.
We're going to have a powerful new moon. And we are in the wave of Maluk. So this is a wave that we just, it's good to focus on our purification. And so, again, it's letting go of what no longer serves us that way, too. Detox like that. So this is the eighth day of that wave, and the eighth is a galactic cone, and we have Seed, the warrior, which is about the servant warrior for galactic humankind. So it's a galactic day, And I think that this fits right in with where we are with this eight tone fine tuning and resonance. That's harmonic resonance, and that's that higher tone from the octave, and that represents the counterclockwise spin of the galactic frequency. So there is harmony when one is in perfect resonance with the universe. Here there is the self-empowered knowledge of at-one-ment, atonement. So it is time to pursue the creative manifestation of the universal values. So eight. And then this warrior aspect is about trusting in our journey and bringing awareness of right action. And it has the gift of communication with the divine and access to cosmic consciousness. So surrender limitation and restriction and hesitation. That's today, and then tomorrow we have a nine Kaban. Well, now we're going to work with that earth energy, Kaban, the earth, in nine with that expanded cycle. And pulsation, greater cycle, completion, expansion, solar. It's called the solar tone. Representing the power of action set into motion. So that's a good energy for the earth to experience, and that earth Kaban is a healer aspect, and we are the keeper of the earth, and it reminds us to be aware of earth energy. Tune in. What is she asking? Access to planetary harmony in this energy. So that's tomorrow. And then on Saturday we have a portal day, and it's a 10 Etnob, the mirror. Or the cutting. We have a cutting ceremony on Saturday. It'll be complete, I'm sure. So Saturday, that 10 tone is manifestation. So let's manifest that mirror image. You are another myself. Very powerful. Etnob is a warrior aspect as well. So work on your groundedness. In that wise use of honesty and self-understanding. You have the gift of scrying the unseen in fluidity and persistence. Let go of the illusions of separateness and fear and abandonment. That's good. And then that's Saturday was that portal day, accentuating everything. And then on Sunday, an 11 Kawak, the storm energy, and 11... That is letting go, but no longer serves, disintegration. Do that with storm energy. Sounds like it could rain. Maybe there'll be thunder and lightning. And then on Monday at 12, a howl, and 12, we have that crystal clarity. It's a howl, and so we're at day 200 in the Zolk'in. A howl being the last solar glyph, the sun, and that's that rise to cosmic consciousness. And so that's a very sweet day for Monday. And then on Tuesday we have a 13 Inish, so we complete the cycle, the wave. On that 13, and we start a new unial as well, Inish. So we have the beginning and the end. The end of the wave is the beginning of the next unial. It's the 12th unial. And so carry through that complex stability that the 12 brings us for the whole wave. And that's a good tone to work with. And that's a date work with Inish, the dragon, the mother, the beginning, unity. And then on Wednesday, we begin a new wave, and it'll be the wave of each. And that's about being open and listening to the mind of spirit, listen to the voices of our ancestors with that energy of the wind. And bringing the wind. winds of change. So Wednesday is also a portal day, so we do that with that extra dimensionality, the portal days that gives us, so that it's powerful, and it's also the new moon. So as we set our intentions, we set our intentions for the wave, we set our intentions for the moon cycle, and we've got a lot of extra, like a lot of extra help with that extra dimensionality. So it's a good day to do our work prayers, setting our intentions. And then on Thursday, we're going to come back. It'll be a 2 arc ball a night, working in that polarity energy of 2 lunar energy in the night. So there you go. That's the week. The Mayan week in review. Remember, the new moon on Wednesday being a portal day, 1 eek, 1 the wind. And then on Saturday, that portal day with a 10 etna manifestation. That maybe that's what that mirror teaches us on Saturday. So those are some powerful days in this beautiful week. Wave of the Maluk, where we have access to our telepathic gifts in a more profound way. So practice your telepathy and work with purification in your life. So I pass the talking stick to you, Marita.
Anything else you need for your classes and things that you're doing?
Yeah, well, I am going to have a call on Sunday, and I'm going to call Penny and talk to her about it. We're going to try seeing if she can't come in on a workout that, because I have the same number still. I haven't fixed it. And I just want to check in at 3 o'clock like I usually do. And if anyone's there and wants to have conversation and talk about things, I'm pretty excited about all the different ways that energy is showing up in our lives, like with Kesha's work with the plasma energy, and how we work with it in this modality. So I'm inspired
and
to
another,
keep the conversation going.
Talking about the energies, Judy Beebe called me. She says, or sent me an email and called me right away. And she has had like 100 beings in her bedroom of the last couple nights, and they've given her the last piece of the puzzle of how to get this energy, you know, what we have in the little spheres, how to actually harness that so we can use it. So she said, I know that when he was so excited, she says, I know that and radionics is the piece of the puzzle, so that's why she called me to see if I could help finish up her project. So that's you know, that's coming together as well. So we've had the hydrogen, and we've had all the things with Keshi as well. So it's really there's a lot of things that are coming together at this time.
Yeah, it is exciting.
So okay, well, we are grateful for you sharing all your wisdom and energy with us, and we'll have Tara and Rama help us understand a little bit about what's going on in the world and who Rama's talked to. The second hour, we have Michael King, and he always has some pretty interesting spiritual ideas to share. We'll see what that is for the second hour. So, Rama, did you talk to anybody today or this week that you want to share with us?
Greetings, everyone, and please do make a contribution for our round table here, our Galactic Stargate round table. Everybody, that's all would be so gratefully received. So you can just go to the website at BBS on this night's event and scroll down and click on PayPal, and there she goes. Okay. So I guess we back up, Rama, huh? You talked to the poppy lady this week.
Yeah.
And it was first and foremost, she was saying that cyclone that was hitting Yemen was rigged, although it was piggybacked on. And what it has to do with this is El Nino. And there's a lot of talk about it that it's, you know, it's the culprit for what happened with all those floods in Texas where people died, and that storm that hit Mexico. Mm-hmm. And then across on the other side of the planet, it's still El Nino that started up the energy for the cyclone to hit Yemen. And now there's another huge one right behind it. And the first one, it washed away buildings and automobiles and anything that wasn't tacked down, including, poorly built structures, homes. 300 to 400 people at least were washed away.
Yes.
It was like 9 to 11 feet of water. We're talking about another Katrina, only that wasn't a Katrina. That was it was Hillary ordering up the Army Corps engineers to blow up the levees. Yet what was going on here is they got 2 years, 1 to 2 years of rain, depending on the location, in 48 hours. In other words, Yemen is so ultra-deserty dry that it just didn't absorb the water. So it came in and it took everything that it came in upon and back out to sea. So put that in the circle of support, please. And then there was this crazy but really interesting story Rama found. There's a spheres going down a roadway.
Our friends are showing up in all kinds of shapes, sizes, and forms. I put this up on the website. Mini UFO follows truck, slows down time.
This was in North Dakota. And, I mean, the story is very interesting because he's got a 22-year-old son with him. And it's at night, and to make a long story short, it was a telepathic sphere. It was a really bright sphere about the size of they said a medium-sized suitcase, yet the picture was not the picture of that, because this little intelligent form would not allow them to take pictures of it.
Right.
And every time he picked up his phone, it just it would go underneath the truck, you know, so that they couldn't get a hold of it.
Or behind the truck.
Or far enough behind so that, you know, it was around the curve. It was a curvy road. And so the all said and done, when they got home that night, you know, they went inside and told his wife what was happening, and she was just looking so shocked and surprised, and what he was saying, did you have experience too? You look like you're not in your body, you know? And so he said, Lloyd's wife answered, no, there's nothing strange going on, yet how did you get here so quick? Did you call from the store? And so Lloyd looked at his watch, then at his phone, which were perfectly synchronized, and realized that they had made a 28-mile journey in no more than 2 or 3 minutes. And the missing time phenomena Lloyd experienced is something that protagonists of UFO encounters routinely describe. It's a well-established fact that time dilates during moments of increased tension, yet missing time cannot be explained this way, and in no way would it affect the laws of physics enough for a truck to travel at 600 miles per hour. That's for sure. And that was the last of the sentence in the whole article. And that was exciting. And they also saw another craft overhead. It was like a half moon with a point in the middle of the half moon, too, on the inside of it. And it used to when it was going to change directions, you could tell because it would light up that cutting edge of the outer part of the half moon in the direction that was going to head. And so there's a lot of interesting things. This is in North Dakota, everybody.
Well, and Rama, I sent you an email about one of our listeners seeing some things that he wanted you to explain. You want to talk about that too?
Yes. Many folks across the planet have been seeing floating cities in the clouds. And I would also say that, yes, on many levels, yes, like Jeannie talks about in Sedona, the light cities are physically manifesting right here, right now. And some of these craft that are being seen are large cities that, you know, they kind of appear as, you know, clouds with buildings, you know, on top of the clouds. And I would say that some of the stuff they're playing with are Men in Black. They are playing with technologies to try to confuse and distract folks. Yet when you see, you know, something like that, and you just get such a feeling in your heart of such magnificent love and ecstasy and joy.
It doesn't really strike fear.
It doesn't create any fear. It's a feeling of, like, welcome home. And they can't create that, the dark side, and manipulate love. They cannot. That is a higher frequency. And also what the article that you sent me, Marita, talked about, that India wants to confiscate the gold from the citizens of India. I got to print that other article out. I got to get paper tomorrow.
And so what's the bright idea? They're broke and they're looking for stuff?
Yeah, essentially what they're trying to do is collect all the gold from all the temples and all the citizenry to rebuild their coffers. Yet a lot of this has to do...
That doesn't go over very well in India, because the Indian people, and every time they get married and every time, I mean, they have the value of gold where they've been buying up gold between China and India. Most of the gold of the planet is sitting in the hands of the people in those two countries.
If you can leverage gold 100 to 1, 200 to 1, and you can get all the gold from the citizens, and then you can lease it out to the futures market, the hedging market, where you can bet 200 to 1, you know, where literally short. You see that kind of margin, it seems, today. So that creates huge wealth gains as well. They're actually offering an interest. They're just not going to take it. What they want to do is say, hey, look, we'll pay you interest every year. We'll pay you 2, 3, 4, 5% interest. Of course, you'll never get your gold back.
That's right.
When you're trying to create a currency of value, and it's the what do you call competition? Well, you do everything you can to destroy the competition. That's what they're doing.
Yes.
Yes, sir.
And ultimately,
and the Prime Minister or the President of India is not a nice person.
No, he's not.
No, he's a murderer.
And
yeah,
I would say ultimately, the higher aspects of what's happening, there is a transfiguration going on in India, and it is very, very large, and it has to do with the fact that all the ancient brotherhoods and sisterhoods are returning now, and the present 3D governments don't have the interests of the people. They don't have the best interests of the people. India, on many levels, is moving from the 19th century into the 21st century. I mean, there are still places in India where, you know, people go to the bathroom right there, you know, and it runs
over
down the street.
Half a billion people still have no toilets at all.
Right, no running water, no facilities. I mean, granted, back in the 70s when I went and swam in the Ganges River, you know, that's kind of taken a risk, you know, because of
big risk. You're
everything
lucky.
That is both alive and dead is in the Ganges River. And, you know, I'm still here, thank my lucky stars. Yet I'm just saying India is going through a huge transfiguration. And it's about the spiritual upward path that doesn't have anything to do with militarizing the governments. Yet there is something that only gets talked about in very small circles about India. That there is a man that has created a free energy technology device very similar to I call him Dr. Tesla, Dr. Tesla's coil. And this man has been threatened within an inch of his life, and he has actually created a free energy machine that we've talked about in the past, where it will virtually make oil just gonzo, bye-bye. And it comes in alignment with what Dr. Cash is doing and so many other folks in India. Also today, I got to speak with George Takei and his partner, Brad. George Takei is everybody.
Well, right before that, I think you got to talk to the King of Swords.
Yes.
And he's
a lot.
That
today.
Was not today. That wasn't today, was it?
That was
yesterday.
Yes.
And he said our satellite in space designed to pick up heat sources, picked up a hot flash at the same time that the Russian plane lost all contact with all control towers in the vicinity. And the flash was located off the plane's side next to the cockpit, the left side of the right side of the plane next to the cockpit. And now they are suspecting a bomb put inside the plane at Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. And I wanted to correct where that is. It's at the southern tip point of what we call Egypt, yet a particular part of Egypt called Sinai. It's not at the corner of the south part of the major mainland of Egypt. No, it's the southern tip of the Sinai Peninsula, which is also Egypt. Anyway, it was, instead of their cover-up story, it was a ground-to-air Israeli strike from the Sinai.
Yes.
That's what it was. So Netanyahu, along with the Saudis, the U.S., and the U.K., all of those people's black ops, they've always wanted World War III at any cost. And so they're going to cover up a story like this that nails their ally, Israel.
Yeah.
So that's what Mr. Cameron is doing right now. And on another spectrum, you know, when Tony Blair got up there the week before and he was trying to nail the invasion and occupation of Iraq on Bush as the reason why there's ISIL here, you know, he still wasn't really apologizing, even though he was just as in bed with Bush Jr. on that score. I still remember him saying that, you know, Saddam Hussein has a delivery system that can deliver the nukes that he has in 45 minutes or less to downtown London, which was just a PhD paper of the University of California San Diego campus talking through his mouth. So there's a lot of nervousness going on when you're watching in full sight these kinds of out-and-out blatancies. And today being Guy Fawkes Day, there are how many cities? 700-plus cities around this planet that are having what they call a million-man march event.
Million mask.
Oh, M-A-S-K. Right. Like the anonymous mask.
Right.
Marches in their respective cities. And they're basically saying that we know what you are, who you are, and what you're doing, and it's time for a revolution of a peaceful revolution.
Right.
We want you guys out of our you know,
out of our hair.
Yes, and
to put it nicely.
And in between, I think it's a very important thing to know is that the Keystone Pipe is pretty much a dead story, that Obama is going to reject it and is not going to honor the company in Canada who's, you know, the CEO of the company in Canada wants Obama to just let it lay and not to say anything. And then when they're ready, they'll start it up again. And I don't know if you talk to your people, but I heard it very clearly that Obama's not going to do that at all. He's going to reject the whole thing.
That's right.
And he's not going to wait for them, which is an amazing thing. So, I mean, right behind that, we have the TPP, the full
Transcripts
was released today, and it is a worse horror story than what we thought.
And I did get a message of all kinds of names of people connected with the KKK. I got an email with
it wasn't 1,000, huh?
I don't know if it's 1,000, but it's hundreds and hundreds of Facebook pages of all these people connected with the KKK. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, that guy that started the Nasara blogs and forums, Tim Turner, is on that list. His Facebook page is gone, but you know, he is part of the KKK. What does that tell you?
Oh, there was somebody else that was in that. Tim Turner, and what was the other guy's name?
Hey, didn't Anonymous say he was going to put all the names out there? Is that what you're talking about right now?
Yes.
Okay, it was Anonymous, yeah.
He just didn't count, and he thinks it's hundreds and hundreds instead of...
Yeah, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of names of people connected, you know, high-level...
Members
that are senators, congressmen,
mayors
of major U.S. cities.
Yeah.
I mean, bankers, lawyers, doctors.
Yeah.
The KKK is a worldwide organization.
No.
Oh, that's what this article that I have talks about.
Well,
there's a European KKK group.
Oh, okay. Well, in the United States, it's only about down to 3,500 to 4,500 total. So if it's global, then they've got some buddies out there. I would think in Europe it would be a KKK against...
It's tied in with the Nazis, tied in with the Aryan Nation groups.
Yeah, against anybody that's not that.
That's what this article's talking about.
Yeah, well, primarily, though, in this country, it's against black people.
It's against black people, Islamic people, Hispanic people.
Okay, people that aren't white, Anglo-Saxon, Aryan. Okay, same stuff. Just a slightly different map here, where in Europe it's very strong Nazi stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
okay, so Lady Nada, you also talked to Lady Nada.
Yes.
And she said, we are moving. No questions, no answers. And then Rama proceeded to ask a question. And he said, what do you mean? Lady Master Nada said that as head of the Solar Tribunal and as one of the members of the World Court, we are moving right into, turn page here, right into the faces of the people of Earth. We are your neighbors. Set an extra dinner plate at the table for us. That's all she said.
Yeah.
Have a nice day. And then Sam Cedar said, and what was the name of that show? Majority Report?
Yeah.
He said that Anonymous is doing what needs to be done, emptying the banks. Bank accounts of all of the 13 families, that's a 500,000 plus people and their minions, by millions of members of the Anonymous hacking group. There are millions of hackers that are members all over the planet. And Saint Germain is the overlighting of that whole group. And they're hacking.
It's just a way of, you know, taking the ill-gotten gains from the 13 families, handing it over to the sacred brotherhoods, sisterhoods, who will use this to refurbish the planet, to use a simple word.
Yes, what they're doing is they're economic treasonists.
That's right.
And they're acting with their funds
too big
to destroy the planet. That's basically true, because you cannot continue to move in the fossil fuel arena without doing that.
Yes.
And there's some pretty serious matters that are not really being dealt with about climate change. And, of course, the climate denial scientists, which is like 0.1% that are, you know, getting paid off by the corporations are just saying, oh, there's nothing going on here. But
and Janet Yellen's talking about raising interest rates by December.
Oh, yes, and what I heard on the middle of the night on RT,
yes,
is that Janet Yellen would never raise the interest rates, only in one case, and that would be the dollar would be in such jeopardy of completely going off the board. And so as they're speaking, that there would go to the Fed meeting 11th, 12th, 13th, somewhere in there of December, and raising the interest rates at that time, that means that is the case. That the dollar is off the board. It's it cannot. And Tom Hartman had a little chart up there in his last word or whatever it was. Not last word. I forgot what he calls it at the end of the big picture show. And he showed the debt, the trade debt, which is cut trillions. And he said this is from investing in fake hundreds of trillions of fake money dollars into the hedge funds with no value whatsoever and no gold behind it. And contrary to what people discuss, we will use gold to back this. and it will be representing that whole concept of the golden age of enlightenment. That's what that gold backing is about, that we're going to be doing enlightenment governance,
yes.
A spiritual governance where the ultimate quest, if you might say it that way, is to be in the pathway of the order of the quest, which was a Saint Germain pathway, where the teachings that he gave to start merchant banking will be returned, which will bring that hedge fund right off the board. No
yes.
more hedge funds. Hedge funds are so completely corrupt, and they have no compassion within their, you know, humans are just commodities that are expendable for profit. And same thing with the materials of the planet. You've heard that speech many a time. Bill McKibben gave it just again last week somewhere on Amy. And he just said, we've got 5.5 planets worth of stuff going on here that nobody else has. And it's not possible to, you know, to function that way. So mote it be that these 13 families, I mean, they're emptying their coffers right now. And then Tom the Cat said, and then before I go on, Sam Cedar was just saying, he said all that. And then he said, as you've heard this message this afternoon, that's great. As you missed it, I did not record this or I wouldn't have been able to say it. So
right.
I'm just saying good night and that's it.
Yeah.
And then Tom the Cat said, regarding Anu of the Anunnaki, which is the name for the energy of the sun, although that's a tier below Alcyone. That's the Anunnaki version. And anyway, that Anu has cut off all the help from the Anunnaki overlords. The 13 families have been desperately trying to keep their bank accounts full. Yet what's happening is that the dark Anunnaki, the ones who have not come back to love, who have been helping the 13 families financially, have in their own desperation to save themselves now, seeing the writing on the wall, they've cut off their spigot to the 13 families. And so then Tom the Cat brought up one more thing, and it's talking about Dr. Stephen Bassett gave a speech somewhere this last week, or talk somewhere. Anyway, he brought up the Rockefeller Initiative, and that, in fact, Hillary Clinton is going to be on the Jimmy Kimmel show tonight, and that Tom the Cat was encouraging as many people to Twitter Jimmy Kimmel and say, hey, why don't you ask the big question because you know about it? Ask Hillary, what about the Rockefeller Initiative? And is Lawrence not Rockefeller that you met with your husband, you know, in the 90s? Is that going to happen now? Is ET presence going to be announced on the planet? I thought that would surely be interesting if that got brought up tonight. Anyway, so Dr. Bassett has a something called the paradigm. Did you figure out what the other name of that was?
Oh, I got to look at my.
Anyway, he was addressing his paradigm group.
Yes.
On that issue, and urging people to him to do that to. You know, get it out there. I don't think Hillary feels like she likes her. Okay, what else, Rama? Is there anything else? Yes. Today. You talked about George. And
I didn't.
You didn't complete that. George Takei and his partner, Brad. Yes.
George Takei is the one who plays Mr. Sulu throughout the Star Trek movies. And he started from the very beginning with Gene Roddenberry, William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, DeForest Kelly, all the folks.
Anyway, they said, we can talk to you, Lord Rama, yet this is a private conversation. We love to lie in a formal disclaimer, just for the record. And then he said, we're taking, we're taking on Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, and the Tea Party lunatics who want to give the death penalty to any LGBTQ people. And that they wish to classify all these people as less than human, and that would validate them calling for the death penalty to these people. And he said it is a spiritual crisis we have here in America, and it has to do with how we have been disempowered, denied who we are as goddesses and God beings. And George and Brad went on to say, in some ancient stories, they took the power away from the goddess, as did the church in their dogma. And they gave the power of the goddess to a false pale white male god. And the mystery schools and their teachings took a back seat to the patriarchy and their elitist controlling attitude. And all the wisdom teachings of the divine feminine were given to us by our ancient immortal brothers and sisters who dwelt here since before time. And now all of these teachings are circling to the forefront for the next 2,000 plus years. Prevailing is Lady Master Virgo with mouse medicine, application to detail, purity of heart and mind and body.
Yes.
Precision is, and her mutable earth signature is I analyze, believe it or not. In conclusion, all the hosts of heaven are back here in our midst. The message of unity that Gene Roddenberry brought to humanity with his vision of our future through Star Trek is upon us right in this moment of 2015. And as we, as a world society, can move now beyond all forms of prejudice, religious disparities, and political mind games, a bright future is at our fingertips. And listen to Dr. Keshe, whose plasma technology has brought immortality into reality in the palms of our hands. And they said, Nasara now. And a sign from London's group. Oh, Rama, this is that they're done now. And Rama saw this on his, he showed me on his phone pictures. And a sign from London's anonymous group says, quote, sorry for the inconvenience. We are trying to change the world. So George and Brad, P.S., George and Brad are in a process of a major lawsuit against Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and the Koch brothers for calling for the death penalty for all LGBTQ people who are being just who they are. So that's another piece of that.
Hey, I have a question if I could.
Sure. Yes, yes, Kathy, I love your questions. Go
ahead.
Oh,
thank you. Well, I think you probably saw it on Huffington Post. They were talking about, there was a picture of a woman during the shooting of JFK. I thought maybe we could address if you knew anything about that. They call her the mystery woman who, as everybody is running away when the shooting starts, she's standing her ground and taking pictures, yet they don't know who she is. What can you share with us about that, if anything?
Wait, the shooting when and where?
The JFK shooting in Dallas. There's a picture of a woman.
Girl.
It's on Huffington Post today. You know, as you get an AOL, I'm an AOL girl, and all the stuff comes up on what's in the news.
Yes.
They show her as the mystery woman. They call her the babushka because of her attire. And she's not running. She's standing there taking pictures of everything that's happening with him being shot while everybody is running in the opposite direction. They don't know who she is.
Wow.
I thought maybe you'd know something about it.
I didn't see that article yet. What I can say about that is that there are still so many pieces that have not been filled in about what actually happened that day in Dallas. And the number one story I know about that from JFK's lips to my ears is the fact he was going to come forward along with Marilyn Monroe, Bobby Kennedy Sr., and tell the world that our galactic brothers and sisters are here, and it's time, and totally dissolve the CIA and the FBI, and totally...
Well, that's the other thing. He blew the lid off of the CIA.
Right, and dissolve the Federal Reserve. Get rid of it and go back to the gold standard. That is some of the major reasons they killed that clone of JFK.
And the reason that JFK knew to get a clone of himself was because Ruth Montgomery, as one of the astrologers that he had, told him.
That's right.
In no uncertain terms that if he went to Dallas in the physical, he would be dead.
Both Gene Dixon and Ruth
Montgomery. Oh, yeah, Gene Dixon did too. That's right.
She was a personal friend of his. And, you know, that doesn't get brought up. Very much at all.
Wait, did you say in the past that it was Schwarzkopf that shot him?
Yes.
Yes, from the grassy knoll that
General
they tried
to... Norman Schwarzkopf.
He was on the
what
grassy
knoll. The driver
knoll.
Turned around and shot him. They say the driver did that. So there's that story. What's that about?
There's more than one shot. He had three bullets in his head.
Right.
Yeah,
that's why they did all the cover-up of all the...
Two bullets from the front and one from the back. The grassy knoll got him in the back. There was another person, I don't remember who it was, but there was an overpass, you know, that they were coming to. And there was like this barred sort of side sewer. And the man was in there taking a shot through those bars. And that shot hit him too, and then the driver. So there was three shots.
And Oswald was just a patsy, a fall guy.
And see, what they did is they did surgery when they got the body to Washington D.C. The hospital Bethesda Naval Hospital. Did surgery and changed everything.
That's right.
They changed everything, and so everything's been faked. And,
you know, so I just want to make a point about this because we know the same thing with Diana was that she had a clone there. So when, let's say, these two figures that are in a position to know that they're going to be taken out and they have a clone, they know that's it for them. They can never show up again. They know that's their death day in the sense of having an everyday world and being in a position of being president or being, you know, one of the Queen's people, you know. I mean, I'm not putting that very well, but you know what I'm saying. That they know that even though why would they go? What would be the point of going if they know that's the last day of their lives?
Well, I will say this.
What was the question?
As Nassara is.
They know they have to have a clone so that they, if they're killed, they won't be killed, but they're basically, their life is over, completely over.
No, the clone was killed and he's fine.
Right.
No, my point is that even though the clone is killed, he knew that would be his death day. His life is over. Nobody's ever going to be able to see him in person again.
Oh, yes. He will be back after Nassara's
death. That's his life going forward. There's no presidency anymore. There's no mothering her two sons. You know, those things are over.
Oh, yeah. He knew that. I'm just going to tell you that JFK was a very enlightened soul.
Yes.
And he knew what he came here to do.
Yes. And
sometimes it did look like that, being a ladies' man, but there's a consciousness that goes deeper than those things.
And after Nassara is announced and fully brought into the faces of the world. Lady Di and Doty will be back. JFK Sr. will be back.
King Hussein will be back.
Right.
He's not dead either.
No. And Mr. Sodom Hottam.
He'll be back too, but he'll be back in a different state.
That's right.
He's sitting in the brig, and he's got Hitler in there to talk to.
Along with Mr. Osama, what's his name? All of this has been a giant fiasco of astronomical proportions.
Which Osama? Because the real Osama died of
Tim Osman.
Yeah, that's the fake Osama. The real Osama
died.
The
CIA partner of Bush.
Yeah, the real Osama died of a kidney failure in Dubai.
That's right.
In the hospital. And then there's a third one, too, that ended up in the hospital in Minnesota and died, too. And whatever that was over there in Pakistan, it's a joke.
And all of this has to do with this gigantic cover-up that has been going on since the Roswell incident and before.
That brings up the Brits, you know, they put this big hoopla on and they wouldn't let any flights go in and out of Sharm el-Sheikh, and said that they didn't want to have any more bomb threats or anything on their planes or anybody get killed, when in reality Israel did this. And all of these governments, that's including Germany and France and, you know, the G8, are all sitting there covering up for this, because if one has done this, then they're all in the same trouble, because they're all in that same state. And again, until you see it, you know the Doubting Thomas is still here, but Obama's a double agent and he's not guilty.
And he is moving forward with closing Gitmo Bay, and the Republicans are screaming to high heaven, let's get rid of the black guy right now.
Well, of course, because it blows their cover again.
Yeah.
And whenever you have come to the end of a place here, Michael King is with us. So
okay.
Just finish up what you need to.
Okay, I'll just say really quick that there's a piece that's bringing Sibel Edmonds to the forefront again.
Right.
And it says here, FBI whistleblower Sibel Edmonds fights former Speaker Hastert's plea deal because she knows so much more. I won't tell the whole story now. But this is by Cynthia McKinney. Mm-hmm. And it's called Espionage, Sibel Edmonds Whistleblower. Yeah. So that's a very interesting story, because she's bringing up a whole lot of things.
And one more thing.
At the same time.
One more thing. An object has come out of a black hole.
Oh, yeah, this.
And this has happened between November 1st and now. And NASA released this, yet NASA is not controlled by the public. It is controlled by the Pentagon. And it's just a front for, like what E.T. Corey talks about, the, you know, secret space command, where they have abducted.
Yes, you don't have to know a whole lot about science to know that black holes typically suck things in, now not spew things out. Yet NASA just spotted something mighty strange at the supermassive black hole Markarian 335. Two of NASA's space telescopes, including the Nuclear Spectroscope Telescope Array, or NuSTAR, miraculously observed a black hole's corona launched away from the supermassive black hole. Then a massive pulse of X-ray energy spewed out. So that's what exactly happened. That's what scientists are trying to figure out now. This is the first time we have been able to link the launching of the corona to a flare. Dan Wickens of St. Mary's University said, "This will help us understand how supermassive black holes power some of the brightest objects in the universe." That's good for now. Pass the talking stick to our brother Michael, another supernova in our midst.
Oh, well, thank you, Tara and Rama, and welcome, Michael King, to our call tonight. Can you hear us okay?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
It sounds perfect to me.
Perfect.
So, what would you like to share with us this evening?
Well, I've been tossing around what you might be interested in. Tonight we've talked a lot about health products, spiritual endeavors, inner healing, and gardening from time to time. And so before I pick a subject, I would like to see if there's an interest, a specific subject that somebody wants to cover before I go into telling you something about my garden.
Okay. Well, if there's anyone who wishes to call in and ask questions, you can call 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471, and that's a free call for the United States and Canada. And so...
So in the meanwhile, if we're waiting...
Yes, go ahead.
I'll share with you the experiences I had. Since I'm a passionate advocate of gardening, mostly for the spiritual benefits, secondly for the nutritional benefits that are superior to what you can buy from a health food store, and then for the importance that it plays a role in today, meaning we may need to be providing for ourselves and for a period of time in the next 12 months. There may be several weeks in a row where our grocery stores won't be stocked or where our power will be out, partly because of the winter, partly because of possibly other banking issues, transitions that are going on across the globe, and this cycle of change that we have already entered into. So the idea of being able to prepare for yourself, of course, at this late stage is not practical to begin growing something and expect it to be totally fulfilling. But I wanted to inspire any budding gardeners or those who have a long-term history of farming and gardening like yourself, Marita, that as you well know, how rewarding it is to just put your hands in the dirt, walk on the soil, and watch as you plant a seed in the ground and watch it sprout, and then watch as it grows and matures and fruits. The beauty and the marvel at the natural order and the connection that we can have as we give love to something, a garden that we create, and it gives back not only of its produce, but also of its spiritual influences, the way it nurtures the soul. Kids that are being brought in to growing classes or teaching people how to grow things, especially kids that have been on the street or kids that are in a juvenile hall and so forth, they're brought in and taught how to tend a greenhouse, how to plant, how to seed things, and how to build a soil, and how to compost and so forth. And they've noticed that these kids that are kind of bouncing off the walls when they walk through the door put their hands in the soil, and it just calms them right down. It's, there's a change that goes on inside of us as we tend to Mother Nature's job of growing things and manicuring a garden specifically around our home. So the magic that takes place from doing this is part of what awakens a soul to greater heights of spiritual insight or depth or open-heartedness, whatever you want to call that. It's really about opening of the heart, and that I equate to being synonymous to spiritual awakening. So the gardens helped us to open the heart. So much like we have the ormolite clay, an earthen product, taken a little bit every day, it opens the heart more and more. It just causes conversations to smooth out. It causes teenagers to awaken and become more cooperative around the house. It increases alertness. Well, we use ormolite in our garden in the liquid gold product. And it enlivens the plants. And then they have the vitality or greater energetic quality that gives back to us as we walk through and view this beautiful growing plants and the fruits. So what I'm suggesting here and hoping to inspire any of those budding gardeners or those who are just contemplating this, and maybe a few who haven't considered it seriously, to give some careful consideration to planting anything, even if you're on a balcony on a high-rise. Put some planter boxes out on the balcony and grow whatever you can. The connection to the earth is absolutely pivotal to spiritual development. So it's all about the oneness of life. So we cannot ignore this physical part and expect to stay balanced. So to demonstrate what can be done, to demonstrate how we can succeed even in our first year of effort, I want to share some of the details of this last year and a half of my own beginning of a brand new garden. Very little to start with. I brought some soils from a couple of compost bins that I had been nurturing while not in a location where I had a garden. And so I was gardening in pots, and we have about 70 plants here in the office, and so I was using that as my ongoing garden. So I brought some of the, I was composting always, growing dirt, growing worms, and of course we use some of that in the making of liquid gold, which is our liquid soil amendment. So I brought that, I inoculated some growing bins, and holes in the ground that I dug near trees to attract the worms that were already in the soil. And I have some raised bed compost bins or raised compost bins that had access to the soil beneath. So they're basically wooden boxes. And I filled them with straw, garden kitchen scraps, and various coffee grounds from local organic shops, and just layered it in little by little. And so I had some soil that I was building, and during the winter, last winter, I grew these big piles in an area, and we had moved into a new place and had a 1,000-square-foot fenced-off area. So I began making these big piles of composted material layered with straw, clay, various kitchen scraps and coffee grounds, and more straw and clay and soil, always soil, mixing everything with soil, brought in some manure from some aged manure from cows and llamas from friends, and began maturing soil. So I grew dirt during the whole of last winter. And in my garden, I was growing these big piles that were like 2 or 3 feet tall. Some of them were 3 or 4, 5, 6 feet wide and 8 feet long. And when it came time to getting close to plant, I would slice these beds up, leave them, the rest of it intact, build a raised bed cedar fence around it using cedar fencing material. Basically $2 a plank for 6 feet and a 5 foot, 6 foot, or 8 foot lengths. And And so I built that with 2x2 squares. So it's not a really sturdy, like a 2x4 type bed, but it was plenty sturdy for my purposes. And in some cases, I built a double wall where I put straw in between the two cedar walls that were 2 or 3 feet tall. And the center bed I filled with dirt and layered it in, like always, some compostable dirt and scraps and so forth, and then planted on the very top layer and mulched that pretty good after the plants came up. So I built 11
Michael,
or 12.
Let me ask you a question. When you you did the double wall, were you ever covering the top with anything in order to get through the winter with it, or were you just doing that for whatever it provided?
Last winter, we only grew some kale, carrots, onions, and garlic. So it was all survived the winter well. And where I did the double walls, I had buried some asparagus, and the rest of the beds were bare until spring. So this, now that it's winter, I will be covering some of the beds that still have some plants in them to extend them through the winter and then continue to grow what we can, you know, winter produce in them. Yeah, we will be doing it this year. Last year I didn't because there wasn't a need for it. I didn't have anything to protect. But I did build up on the side walls. The 2x2 that held the frame together, I would just screw the boards into. I left them about a foot and a half taller than the bed itself, which was about 2 feet off the ground. So the bed is 2 feet from the ground, 2 feet deep, and then another foot and a half or so, I've got these 2x2 sticking up for that very reason, mm-hmm. that I would be able to attach more boards to it and then cover it in a square or rectangle. So the interesting thing, that by building these beds out, I was fairly late planting some of the produce because I was building beds, and we were working, early morning, working during the early mornings before coming to the office and then working on weekends. So I spent a lot of hours just out of a passion for that and also out of urgency to get things growing before it got too late in the summer. We still were able to harvest over 700 pounds of produce so far. Over 250 pounds were tomatoes, and we had two beds of tomatoes. We have they're still surviving the cold nights that are in the 30s. We might get a freeze here shortly, so we're going to pick, probably Sunday night, pick what we have to. But I'm going to cover one or two of the plants, one that was the youngest that's just now beginning to show some red tomatoes. It was really healthy plant. Each of the beds grew over 8 feet tall, and massive amounts of produce in the tomatoes. I'm referring to tomatoes here. And so this latecomer, it was an experiment to see, again, a comparison. There was a tomato that sort of volunteered in the aisle, and then this one in a 2 foot deep bed. And the aisle plant grew up about probably 6 feet tall, but it not a whole lot of branching out. I mean, there was some, but it wasn't massive, whereas the other plant literally consumed a 4x4 square 8 feet tall. And so, and it is covered with tomatoes, whereas the other one has maybe, 15 or 20 tomatoes on it. So there's a difference in soil depth and soil quality that obviously is demonstrated by the comparison of these two right next to each other. So, and what I'm saying here is that it is simple, that you don't really have to have extremely special soils. You just have to follow a few guidelines in order to create a reasonable growing medium for high quality plants. And we grew, I've got, I don't know, 12 or so beds. Some of them are very long and some are short. Some are rectangular and square. And we grew watermelons, squashes, pumpkins, a lot of basil, cilantro, kale, carrots, onions, lots of tomatoes, some okra, cukes, Jerusalem artichokes, potatoes.
No asparagus?
Pardon?
No asparagus, Michael?
My asparagus didn't show up. It showed up. Yeah, there was. It was. They were young. They weren't fully mature asparagus roots, but we did get early on just some very small, thin ones, and then they died back. So I don't know. I'll be digging up that bed shortly because the rest of it's about gone. But what I learned, my asparagus bed was one of those beds that I secured an outside compost or soil mixture from a guy that I trusted to be really top in his field in this neighborhood. The only problem is that his previous blend to this current blend, because I had a blend from him about 4 years ago, in this current blend, he put a lot more bark directly from the forest. So it's true forest bark, not the stuff you get from the wood mills, byproducts or Joe Grow dump material. He was getting it right out of the forest. But none of the beds that I had bark in did well. And this is
why.
Do you
think it just wasn't fully composted yet? I mean, it hadn't. Is it a matter that it hasn't had enough time, or is it the kind of wood it is? What do you contribute it to?
I believe that bark, if you look at nature, how does nature install bark in the soil? And yeah, you have some fallen trees, and the fungus goes in and takes it out, and that becomes a seedbed for mycorrhizae running throughout the forest. But that's a different scenario where you have a lot of wood. What you have in forests and naturally occurring is you'll have a tree that will drop little branches, and if the soil is really bad, it will drop a lot of branches with a lot of leaves in order to replenish the soil over time. But typically, if you have a decent soil, the trees don't drop a lot of wood. They don't drop branches or little twigs a lot. They'll drop a lot of leaves, which is deciduous if they are. And that helps to replenish the soil. But what I'm seeing that we're doing is in our growing mediums that you buy in the store is they're a vast majority of the soil blends in bags are now bark. And I took, that as a sign that it was a good thing over the years. And I have noticed where everywhere I have bark in the soil that is not a full powder mixed with a lot of really good soil, then I'd say it's never produced up to par. I've had a hard time getting germination rates in those beds. They're much more prone to disease, even though I have an extremely low disease rate in gardens, very few bugs, if any. But I have seen where my plants are, if they're stressed in some way, either through overgrowth or through just the excessive bark, they're just not as strong. They're not as violent. They're much more likely to attract bugs, pests, and not touch a bed right next to it that had no bark in it. They won't travel. They'll travel across the garden to a highly stressed bed, but that had bark in it, but not the ones who never had bark. So it was graphically demonstrated in this garden. I was very hesitant to take that soil, but I thought, well, this guy knows his stuff. I'm going to trust him. I'm just a newbie. I'm probably 2006, seven or eight is when I started seriously taking garden to heart, and so I'm 7 years and kind of learning as we go. But what I've found, the greatest successes, we had a bell pepper plant that produced 18 good-sized bell peppers that went to red, red bells. And then I just counted another 10 or 12 young ones that if we had the warm weather, if we had planted them sooner, we might have gotten well over 20, you know, healthy, large bell peppers off of that one plant. So, and the other bell pepper plants that we did have, they produced at least 10 or 12 and still had some small buds.
Let me just say, so for somebody who's not as intent about the gardening as we are, and they want to get a box on their back patio or do some of this, how can they best, I mean, can they go buy some organic soil in a bag and then put some, like, of the Ocean Gold in it, or what, is it Ocean Gold? It's gold something.
Oh, Liquid Gold?
Liquid Gold.
Yeah.
I knew there's another company, Ocean Gold. I knew that wasn't right. They need to inoculate it to get the good bugs in it.
Yeah.
So how could somebody that doesn't want to go through all that what you're doing, how can we get them started and to be able to do something in pots or in a box or something on their patio, or, you know, how can they get started?
Okay. So there's two ways. If you have time to grow your own soil, which is I heartily recommend, I would layer up during the winter. I would layer up in a box. You have a raised bed. You can build a box. Just make a square out of 2x6s or 2x8s, or use the cheaper version of cedar fencing and some 2x2s, and build it. In your case, you'll probably have to put a bottom on it, but it does need to drain so that, you know, you don't oversaturate your soil, you know, holding too much water. But anyway, you build your container, and it drains, and if necessary, you can use a plastic container, plastic pot. I'm thinking a fairly large size, but if you have to go smaller, you can buy, you know, at the Grange or in the good nurseries, you can buy any kind of a plastic container, round, square, rectangle, of any kind. Okay, then preferably the deeper the better, because root depth is absolutely critical to some of the success that you'll achieve. So root depth, and then you begin by putting straw or alfalfa, if you can get a hold of that, which for on a balcony, that's going to be, you're going to have to bring things up in bags. So you'll look for bagged alfalfa chips or pellets, something like that. You'll want some straw or leaves. Now, if you've got leaves in your neighborhood, you can get them from the neighbors or somehow from a tree that you have access to. Deciduous leaves are absolutely one of the best soil makers. You will also need some kind of a bagged version of soil, potting soil. And in that soil, you want to attempt, this is almost impossible, but try your best to get a version that has no peat moss, no bark, but uses coconut fiber, and it'll have some kind of volcanic rock like pumice or perlite or something of that nature in there. It'll have some sand. It'll have some mycorrhiza. It'll have some friendly bacteria for the soil, and it might have some bat guano, you know, pre-blended stuff. If you can't find something that isn't already imbued with bark, then talk to one of your local growers, local friend farmers or something, and get some of, you know, buy some soil from them, bring it home in 5 gallon buckets. I grow a lot of stuff in 5 gallon buckets when necessary, or just bring, I carry a lot of soil and store it in that, and have worm bins even in 5 gallon buckets with holes on the bottom. So, and have another bucket underneath to capture the water, and I use that water as a worm wash. We call it worm casting wash, or worm juice, they call it. And you spray that on your soil as well to inoculate, you know, provide the mycorrhizae and bacteria and friendly goodies that the soil needs. So, as you get this compostable materials, that might be straw, alfalfa, it might be kitchen scraps. You want some soil to mix all of your compostable materials. You want to sort of mix it in with the straw, the alfalfa, definitely all your kitchen scraps and coffee grounds and tea grounds need to be mixed together with some soil. It causes the bacteria in the soil, break everything down. Layer it in, straw, scraps, soil, straw, scraps, soil. Now, the soil can be your bagged material that you buy from the nursery, the best you can get. If you have to go with something that's got barky, you might be able to sift out some of the excess bark and then add some extra mycorrhizae which is what breaks the bark down faster. So you may not get your best produce the next year, but you could the following year. If you are inoculating it with further bacteria like liquid gold, and so this is how you could improve your soil year by year, because soil continuously gets better year by year through regular application of liquid gold. We've watched that over and over again. So then you're layering, and leaves, straw and leaves, we'll treat synonymous, but leaves are superior. Deciduous leaves, I'm partial to the red maples or other kind of maple leaves. The one leaves you want to avoid would be your high tannin leaves like oak, walnut, not sure, maybe chestnut, but I'm not sure. But the idea is you want the birch leaves, the alder, the maples, etc.
When we have a lot of pines, like the Scotch pines or the white pines, those would be very acid, wouldn't they?
They will be. And I noticed that the worms love an acid environment like that. And so if you're going to grow tomatoes, that's going to be an ideal. It depends on what you're going to plant in there. There's nothing wrong with putting them in. The worms will balance things out to a certain degree. Once some roots start going down, they tend to convert soil to match what the plant needs if there's enough worms in there. So this is the big trick, is keeping your worms alive. Now, so I have watched, I have had success with pine needles, and surprisingly citrus fruits and everything, you know, in a compost pile, they do fine, contrary to what some people say. The things you don't put in your compost would be fats, meats, bone, the animal products, especially if your animal's eating normal store-bought dog and cat food, or if they've been to the vet and they've got chemicals in their body now. And because typically, you know, animals and human waste is the way nature intended for the soils to be inoculated with friendly bacteria. Our challenge is that we've got, you know, chemicals in our system, you know, pharmaceutical drugs and various foods, fast food chemicals, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's not always the best unless you're really, you know, pure, clean diet and you have a pretty good history of such. You've done a whole lot of clay, but has eaten a whole bunch of clay. But truthfully, even human urine has some of the highest sources of nitrogen and some of the best biology for your plants in the soil, so much, not so much on the plant, but, you know, human urine diluted 10 to 1 produces a nutrient-dense, biologically active fertilizer with lots of nitrogen in it for plants, with one advantage, one distinct advantage, and that is you want your plants to grow specifically for your DNA, your health problems. You want to inoculate it with your sweat, your biological material, and urine is a simple way to do that. Your sweat from your hands, on your feet. You want to get that energy in the soil. So that's why putting hands in the soil is a big part of giving your garden information about what your needs are, who you are, what your needs are, and what they can do to help you the most. And so there is a symbiotic relationship that takes place between you and those plants, you and your garden in general. So when you start, you walk through your garden gate, there is this ambiance that already starts to nurture you. And then because you put your genetic information into the soil, the plants have begun to draw energy, knowledge, wisdom from the astrological side of things, the atmosphere, and from the earth itself, and collected nutrients that are uniquely tailored for your needs. So this is an important piece of information, and it's part of how we commune with God through nature. Very important. And so it has an awakening influence. It is part of what really helps us to open the heart. And opening the heart is the number one secret to enlightenment, because the condition of the heart has been, always was, the breaker, or the reason why we either make it or don't. It's the reason why we evolve or we devolve. It's whether we choose to leave our heart open, whether we choose to close it, whether, you know, we take offense to a wrong suffered, or whether we realize that we forgive ourselves for creating whatever happened to us by taking responsibility. And I know that's a step beyond what is considered. You know, we're not talking about just forgiving somebody for messing up your life. Okay, that's not the answer. The answer is to realize that this whole material world is a hologram that we have helped to create, and our participation in it is of our own making. So if we created it, we have nothing to be angry about. And we have nothing to forgive, really, because we did it to ourselves. So in truth, we just have to forgive ourselves for being the cause of what we have experienced throughout life. And I know that's a tough cookie to swallow sometimes, given our preference for victim mentality. But the truth is, the more we contemplate that and the more we realize it's the truth of its essence, and the more we apply it to our life, that's how we set ourselves free. Well, that means that in those areas where we took the victim stance and closed our hearts, we hurt ourselves. We closed ourselves off. We became smaller. We became less. We held a grudge. We sought some revenge, or we played the self-pity game. And as a result, we became smaller. We forgot that we are divine beings, that we are one with God, that we are equal in that respect, that there's only one of us, even the so-called perpetrators in our life, there's only one of us. We're all in it together. None of this is really happening. This is a hologram, and we're part of the creators of it. So we have to take responsibility in that respect if we want true freedom. Engaging with the soil, if I can go back to that, allows us to relax. It discharges a lot of static energy that builds up when we live a fast-paced, high-rise kind of living, you know, constantly attached to our cell phones, video games, and texting and Facebook and whatnot. Not that they have no value in this day and age, but because they are helping many to awaken in other ways. But I'm saying that there is a greater, more direct awakening source, and that is hands in the soil, plant something, watch it grow. Consume the produce from what you have grown. And it will nourish you uniquely. And ultimately, by taking this to the extreme, where you take 2 or 3 or 4 acres of land and you grow it a certain way with forest, pond, garden, and home, and you grow all your own food because you've planted 400 or 500 species of plants, and you have a forest that keeps the microbiology in the soil ideal, then you now have the ability to heal all of your health problems and to awaken completely over time, if not in, you know, over generations, if not in this lifetime. So you have that influential quality right there at home, right out your back door, where you can experience God through nature, and you can awaken more rapidly, more adeptly, and combine that with all of your other studies and approaches and spiritual practices, and you will see that it'll take you light years ahead. So the calming is of your connection with the garden, calming that comes from that connection, is a big part of this whole awakening process. So for all these reasons, I recommend grow anything, even if it's just flowers in your house or on the patio. Grow something. It helps to move in that direction, and then aspire to have a place to live whereby you can convert a yard, a grassy lawn, into a living garden space that feeds you year-round, or whatever you can put together here. Aspire to it, and then that's what causes the universe to get these wheels in motion to make those things happen. This is a critical thing, not just because of our crisis state as a world, and how that would help the environment and so forth by doing so, but also to take care of yourself and your families, and even for many generations to come.
Hey, Michael. Okay.
Yes.
You know, on this way of thinking, I'm remembering there was something that you shared with us in the past about something about getting your saliva, or wasn't just yes. about your sweat in your hands, or what was that piece? There's a piece okay. in my head that I can't put together.
Yes. So this came from the anesthesia material
right. By
Vladimir Migre. For those who haven't read that, it's an extremely valuable, insightful material, if you can get through the first book, which is a little more tough because of Vladimir, the author's unconscious nature, but he grows and matures over time. So bear with it, but the idea, there's, I think, 9 books now, and it's all about a woman in the Siberian taiga that has her own garden there and lives without homes and technology or money. And she's extremely advanced, and more so than our best supercomputers. And one of her recommendations, in order to inoculate the seed, you take a sampling of the seeds that you intend to plant in your garden. Doesn't have to be more than, you know, 2 or 3 seeds of each species of plant that you want to put in. Put that, stand on the soil barefoot where you intend to plant, roughly, you know, and put the seeds in your mouth for 9 minutes. And you basically hold the seeds there so your saliva is connecting and saturating the seed. And then after 9 minutes of quiet contemplation, you know, with your feet connected to the soil and the seeds in your mouth, then you remove the seeds, plant them in the soil where you want them, and that has imbued those seeds with specific information about your DNA and your health requirements. And they already begin, as they sprout, they begin to collect the information from the heavens and the earth to nourish you properly. Now, it's important that after you put those seeds in the soil, that don't water them for about 3 days so as not to wash them out, and let that information saturate not just the seeds but also the soil, and then they will start to germinate and carry that information with them. And then as you continue to work the soil, And as you continue to plant and so forth, you can perform this as you feel it's necessary, you know, on new plantings, new seeds. But you can also inoculate your garden with the urine. I wouldn't necessarily go the route of the feces. That's a little different. You know, we are meat eaters as a general rule in our society, and that is less beneficial in a compost environment than the vegetarian produce going through the gut. However, that's so it's more risky for lots of reasons. Who knows what kind of chemicals might still be in the meat, et cetera, et cetera. It's an unknown factor these days, unless you're killing your own produce. But also, there is something about, you know, the fermentation of meat going through the digestive tract at 98.6 that causes parasites and so forth to develop. So, interestingly, on that subject, if I can get a little gross here, I dug a couple of holes in the ground near an apple tree, and I have my compost bins under the apple tree, and everything has access to all the worms that happen to live in the soil, and any worms in my compost bins can obviously dive down deep when it gets really cold so they can spare themselves the freeze. And then in spring, all I have to do is throw some more fresh food in there, and they come up, and they all come back. You know, so it's really about they know where the food is at, and if it smells good, they're going for it. So they'll all come back, and many more from around the neighborhood if you've got some really, really good stuff, you know, in this hole in the ground. So and now I've lost my train of thought. I'm sorry. So,
well, you said it was gross. You said this is going to be really gross.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
So a friend says, hey, I've got this pork. It's gone bad. We can't eat it now. Do you want it, you know, for compost? And I thought, I don't know, but I'll give it a try. So I put all of this pork and bones and fat and meat in the ground. Her husband was dying of cancer, by the way. And so we'll leave that as it may. Now we all know that meat causes cancer because they made a big deal about it. That was a living example of someone who lived a not-so-healthy diet and ate a lot of meat. And so I ended up with this organically grown pig byproducts. So I put it in one of my compost holes. It's actually in the winter. And interestingly, I dug that up. It was last, I think it was the earlier spring this year. And I dug it up once. I pulled a lot of stuff out that wasn't decomposing. The raccoons liked it. And then I found some more I left in there, and I just finished digging that up last week. And I was shocked to see that the fat was still fat. Almost none of it had decomposed. And it had been well over 6, maybe 9 months. I don't know.
That's scary.
Yeah.
One of the things, Michael, that I would caution people as far as putting the seeds in their mouth, unless you've saved your own seeds or you know that they're organic for sure, because so much of our seeds now, they put a lot of chemicals on them. So you make sure you have an organic seed or seed that you've saved before you go trying the saliva thing in your mouth.
Really smart. Thank you for saying that. That was a very, very important concept.
I don't know what would happen if you just spit on them and let them lay in the saliva. It wouldn't be maybe you could do that in your hand or something.
Yes.
'Cause it still could get into your system through the hand, but maybe not as wouldn't be as contaminating as having it in your mouth. I don't know.
Good concept. I hadn't thought of that. That's a great idea.
Well, you know, I have another question that's a burning question because you were talking about the bark. And you know how a lot of us, and it's a decorative thing as well, we have the pine bark, you know, on top of our, whether it's flowers or gardens. you know, under trees, everywhere you go, it's pretty and all of that. Would you say that that's not healthy in from what I'm hearing from you?
Correct. And I have gotten feedback from others who have confirmed that once they didn't have bark on top of their soil and their plants never had problems, they never yellowed, you know, per se, they didn't have any, you know, bugs per se, then they brought in some bark, covered their soils, and that was the year that things didn't grow very well, things turned yellow fast, they were more prone to insect damage, etc. So, yeah, I'd take it off. And, you know, my office plants, some of them are living examples. I brought in some of that special barky soil from this guy who I figured knew, you know, soils. And I put it in a lot of my potted plants here. I repotted and started having trouble until I kept, you know, hired somebody to actually water with liquid gold every week. And so we're surviving it. But because it's breaking down the soil, but frankly, it was a real struggle for the first year or year and a half to 2 years. It was a real struggle with some of these high bark soil, potted soils, and I just haven't had time to change the soils to the good stuff. But because I'm just now, this year, I finally made some good stuff using the simple materials that run through your household on a daily basis. And, you know, coffee grounds, tea grounds, leaves from the yard. You know, if you just stack those and put some yard soil together with leaves, coffee grounds, and kitchen scraps, that alone will decompose within, you know, 2, 3, 4 months into a really decent soil. If you have grass clippings, you can put that in there as a nitrogen source. If you have our silica-rich clay, I would sprinkle that every time you put another layer of stuff, of goodies, into that bin that you're growing dirt and worms in. Always cover it with a final layer of soil and then some more straw or leaves or something. And the reason for that is to keep the gnats down and keep the soil touching the things that you want to compost really fast. So the biology in the soil will go in there and eat it up really fast. So by making soil like that and putting garden trimmings in there, you know, leaves from the garden, et cetera, all of these things, mix your leaves with soil. Now, if you have something like, if you got chickens, what I've been doing is I will take my leaves, I throw it in the chicken pen, a lot of the garden scraps, not everything, but stuff that they can, that doesn't entangle them when they're kicking around looking for whatever is under there. I throw my alfalfa, I throw my straw, and they mix it up for me. And they get it all, you know, mixed up with dirt because they're scratching looking for worms and bugs and whatnot. They're eating the alfalfa, and they're eating the seeds out of the straw. It's always in there. And then they are adding their own fertilizer to it. So I wait until it starts turning kind of dirt brown, and then I'll rake it up and put that in my compost bin or put it in the bottom of a brand-new raised bed, knowing that 3 months from now that's going to be full of worms and lots of really good soil. And so I'm constantly raking up what the chickens have feasted on for a while and fertilized, and putting that in my compost piles or anywhere else as necessary. So then I'll add some fresh stuff and add soil on top of that, put some fresh coffee grounds, fresh kitchen scraps, and then I'll top that with some more soil, which in this case I'm taking my compost bins, and I went down to a miner shop, you know, for the gold miners and the shops. They have these sifters for $15 to $25, you can buy a 5-gallon bucket sifter, and it's a plastic round thing with a certain screen. And you get one that's a quarter-inch hole. It's a four. They call it four mesh, or four holes per inch. And get a, You can get a 2-mesh that's a half-inch hold. You can get a 4-mesh, and you can get an 8-mesh, which is 1/8-inch holds. And those three sifters I use in the garden. If I have small stuff, small materials, I will take those, especially the 1/4-inch I use the most, and I'll sift my compost bins once they're mature, sift them out, take the big stuff, throw it back in the bin. I'll use that material to top off my fresh produce, or I'll throw all the big stuff in the very bottom of a brand-new raised bed. And I'll take the 1/4-inch material, and I'll use that as my primary soil that I could either use to layer my new garden beds or top off all of my garden beds. So I've been sifting my compost bins, and I've got several buckets. And so when I'm ready, I'm going to top off all of my garden beds with this 1/4-inch material. If I need something to make some liquid gold, or in this case, if you don't have liquid gold, use some of that worm casting sifted an 1/8 inch. You can use the 1/4-inch if you put it in a bag, but you can also just throw in some 1/8-inch material and into a bucket of water and stir it up. Throw in some molasses or honey, raw honey, any kind of quality sugar, Rapunzel's or something like that. Anything sweet, basically, and that will cause the microbes in there to explode. They will just start multiplying off the charts. And you use the soil, your compost soil, the worm bin soil, that you inoculate. It's mature. That's why it's small. It's mature. It's aged. And you put that into the water. You can put, a cup. You can put more. You can put less. It doesn't really matter. So you're inoculating it, and the sweet causes it to explode. If you have nettle leaf and comfrey leaf, then you can put that in there and age it overnight. Some people age it for 2 or 3 weeks, but some people will put bubblers in there to aerate. But I like to just age it for an hour or two or three with the sweets in it, and then strain off all of that through a nylon curtain material. Or any kind of strainer, house strainer, to make it as small as possible. And if it's too big a particle to spray through a garden sprayer, then just, leave it in a 5-gallon bucket and just pour it over over the root zone of the plants that you have, and pour it in the soil wherever you've got. And you use that as a microbial inoculant and a nutrient provision. So I use that method. And I, in combination with our clays, to make liquid gold. So we have ormus-bearing clays. I have, humic acids and additional mycorrhizas and bacteria and all the good stuff. But the ormus clays, the sacred clay, the aquaterra, some of the ancient minerals, all of these mineral sources are in there. And I add a number of other things. And I spin that one for 6 days in an aerated environment. Vortexed, and then I use worm casting wash, the same material. I've got the 5-gallon buckets with holes in the bottom filled with soil, and I run some water through that and collect this worm juice. And part of my worm juice is, by the way, there's lots of worms in there because it's fresh quality soil, highly microbialized from composting. And also have soldier fly larvae, which is another topic altogether we won't go into, but they're a special kind of breed of a grub, you could say. It looks like a grub. Turns into a wasp-looking type fly that lives 4 or 5 days, lays very benign, very safe, doesn't sting or anything, and drops about 800 or 900 eggs into your compost pile, flies around for a little while, and then goes back to your pile and drops about 800 or 900 eggs. And then you get a whole bunch of these little grubby things, and they consume fresh produce like no tomorrow. And so they produce.
And what are they called, Michael?
They're called soldier fly larvae.
How do you spell that?
Soldier, like the war guy.
Okay.
Soldier fly, and the larvae, like a caterpillar.
Right.
And they look a little grub-like,
Okay.
Like a maggot. But they're very safe, and they're constantly moving. They just can't stop unless it's really cold. And so they're superb at consuming coffee grounds, fresh produce of all kinds, in 1 or 2 or 3 days. You know, you put a big batch down there, which would be like a dinner, whatever you threw away for dinner, and they'll have it gone in 1 or 2 or 3 days for the most part. And then as they multiply, you get thousands of them. And then most of those will what they call pupate. They'll cocoon like a butterfly. They'll run off into the grass, and they'll hide for a while. And then they'll turn into this fly, a black wasp-like looking fly, very safe, very benign. And they'll come and fly around for a little while, and then you'll see them just kind of sitting there doing nothing for 1 or 2 days, and then they'll fly around and find a good spot to lay their eggs, bury themselves in it, and lay their eggs and die. They usually don't show up they have these tiny, tiny little worm things that are so tiny, they're just specks to start with, and then they, over 2 or 3 months, they gradually get bigger and bigger, and then they start pupating, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 months, I'm not sure what their cycle is. But then you get all these flies coming back for several more months until it gets too cold, and then they bury themselves or try to stay in the warmer spots because they create a nitrogen-rich environment that's always hot. So I utilize those, and their worm juice, if you wash that, especially if they were influenced by coffee grounds, it is a black worm juice, very rich in nitrogen. So I mix that with the lighter orange worm casting juice and to make my liquid gold. And then I'll add all these mineral type and microbial goodies to the liquid gold and the compost, of which I put special stuff in my compost. I'm going to put my manures, guanos, I'm going to put special mycorrhizal inoculants and bacteria in my compost piles. As I'm layering things on, I'll put seaweeds in there. I've got a bag of non-soil mixture. It's just all the amendments that you would normally mix into a soil blend. You can buy those in some stores. They're just pure amendments without the soil, without the bark, without anything. It's just the mycorrhizas and nutrients and mineral sources, etc., that would make a nice soil blend. So I take that, and that gets sprinkled on layers. And so by the time that's composted in, it's extremely dense with nutrients, with microbials, mycorrhizas, etc. And so then I utilize that to make the liquid gold. And so now you have...
And Michael, I just have now looked at the clock. We are we need to wind this up here. So finish up where your thoughts are, and then also tell people how they can find you. Vitality Herbs and Clay and all of this. So why don't I'll just turn it back to you and let you wind it up, and then make sure people know how to find you.
Okay. Well, you really have the gist of how we grew a garden, and we haven't harvested all of our produce, so we've got over 700 pounds. We're probably going to get roughly 750 pounds of produce this year, first year, first brand new soil creation, etc. So we have some of my older gardens listed on the website if you go to vitalityherbsandclay.com. That's all spelled out, Vitality, V-I-T-A-L-I-T-Y, herbs, plural, A-N-D, clay.com. Look for the farm and garden section. You'll find some of the pictures from my previous gardens. In a few years, I've stopped. Until this year, I'll be posting some more. And then if you want to call, you've got health issues, or you want to talk about the gardening stuff, my office number here is 541-482-9633, 541-482-9633. And then you'll just, if you want to look at the products, we have Silica Rich is the gardening clay. That's the sacred clay version for ag. And then we have the liquid gold. Those are the only two. I do have a product called worm red wigglers with castings and eggs and all. So that's one way to inoculate your worm bin as an option. I have some of that, but not vast amounts at this point in the winter. So I may end up taking that off here shortly. But nevertheless, it's available. So anyway, feel free to look that up or give us a call as you feel you need to. Okay. Anyway, thank you so much, Marita. I'm delighted to chat. And I just want you to know Gary Gilman says hi. I had a good chat with him today.
Okay.
Yeah, well, he was out at your farm helping out or watching what amazing stuff you've been doing there. He was very complimentary.
Well, his daughter was interested in maybe going into the field of food production, and so they came and visited and stayed 3 or 4 days last summer just to find out what college and what course she was going to take. So we thank you very much for sharing all this with you, and I'll try to talk to you sometime maybe tomorrow afternoon. And thank you for the idea of, I've never ever thought about when you do the clay baths, to put a washcloth over the drain and let it go out slowly, because you can reuse that again. And
yes,
I've done that this week. And so thank you for that. Maybe someone else can benefit from that too. So when you're doing the clay baths, it doesn't all go down the drain if you'll just lay your washcloth over the drain.
Excellent. Yes. Great.
I didn't know
about
that.
Yeah, save that. And then you can build it up, because the more clay you end up in the water over time, gradually is better. Building up gradually is better. The more powerful, the more clay, the more powerful the magnetic draw. But, you know, early on it could be too strong, so start small, let it build up, throw in some more every bath, a little bit every time, and it builds up and builds up, and it gets stronger and stronger. Detox.
Well, Michael, I just want to say it's always a heart-expanding experience to listen to you. And, of course, you know we have a guest every week for the most part, and you are still my number one favorite guest.
Thank you.
I must say.
Well, I so much
thank
appreciate
you, Michael.
That. Delight.
Thank you so much. You taught me a lot tonight, like
thank
usual.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate that. I
really
we will
love you see you next time, and blessings on your way. And we'll talk to you soon.
Excellent. Have a great night.
Lots of love.
Bye-bye now.
So, Taran Rama, do you want to just go right on into the last hour here rather than taking a break?
Yes, it's a matter of the time, but we've got a plenty to put your thinking cap back on. Don't think you're not going to have to think on this one. We're going to have Steve Cohen. He spent an hour on the air with Tom Hartman, and he went into real depth about the history of Russia in terms of the Soviet Union and the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks and the wars and the civil war in Russia. I mean, we're just going to learn a lot. And the one thing I learned is humility. Just like we just did with Michael, another subject. But I learned humility when I listened to Steve Cohen. He's Katrina VandenHeuvel's husband, by the way. And he's just saying, and lest we have walked in another's shoes, please do not judge. And that the work that Putin is doing here, with the background and everything, good, bad, and ugly, it's bringing us into a balance between East and West is really what it's doing. And so without me making any more ado, let's get started because of the time, everybody. Okay, here we go. We're going to just change the furniture real quick.
Just a moment.
Almost there now.
Steve Cohen really said a lot today.
Yes, he did. Okay, we're ready now. Here we go.
Turning to the
Democratic lineup said, you got the Bolsheviks, everything from the Bolsheviks to the Mensheviks. And at first, I'd never heard of the Mensheviks, and I was scratching my head going, is this some sort of anti-Semitic slur, you know, Bernie's Jewish or something? I couldn't figure it out. And then somebody called in and said, no, here's the end, and it went on from there. So I thought, I need to talk to Stephen Cohen. Professor Stephen Cohen, contributing editor to The Nation, thenation.com, professor emeritus of Russian studies and politics at NYU and Princeton. His book, Bukharin and the Bolshevik Revolution, is still in print, plus his more recent book, Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, which examines the new Cold War, are both available in paperback. Professor Cohen, welcome back to the program.
So we can thank Ted Cruz for reminding us of 20th century history.
That's correct.
Is there anything else we thank him for?
I can't think of anything. No, I think that pushed that was our irony limit for the day. So
he attended Harvard and Princeton, as I understand.
He did. Yeah.
I don't know his age, but I taught Soviet history at Princeton for 30 years. It's possible he picked this up from me.
Yeah, I think he's in his mid-40s.
For which I apologize.
Okay. Well, that's fascinating.
It is evidence of that old adage that a little knowledge can be extremely dangerous.
Indeed. And that's why I wanted to get a little more knowledge. I'm curious about, and we've got a lot of elbow room here. We've got the whole hour we can talk about this. I mean, we can also talk, if you would like, about, you know, things that are going on in Ukraine and stuff like that we've talked about in the past, Syria. But I'm really curious, what was the through story of the Russian Revolution? Who were the actors, and what can we learn from that? I'm guessing you're familiar with the J-curve theory of, you know, what provokes revolution when expectations, you know, diverge beyond a certain percentage or whatever from reality. You know, I'm curious, what provoked the revolution, the Russian Revolution? How did it happen? How did it ultimately change? How did it become Stalinism? I don't know any of these things, and you know all of this stuff.
So, well, I wouldn't say I know all. Once upon a time, maybe 25 years ago, I knew close to all because that's what I primarily did. I researched the period from the eve of the Russian Revolution, which occurred in 1917, up to about World War II. And I followed everything. And then my research interests turned elsewhere. Soviet-era archives, which had been closed for 70 years, opened up. And not only a young generation, but an older generation that had worked that subject based mainly on print sources, went to those archives. So we now have a very, very large literature that I'm dependent on. I don't do primary research on that period very much. I'll amend that in a minute. Let me say at the beginning, because tribute is due where tribute is due, that I think the preeminent historian of the Russian Revolution, and by the way, the Russian Revolution is often considered to be 1917, from the fall of the Tsar in February through the end of the Russian Civil War, 1921, when the communists or the Bolsheviks consolidated power in Russia. So it's not just the year 1917, but the Civil War, which grew out of the revolution. The preeminent historian of that era, preeminent because even the Russian Academy of Science, by making him an honorary member, is an American. And a dear friend of mine, Professor Alexander Rabinowitz, who is Professor Emeritus of History at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana, where I was an undergraduate and where he and I met. But over the years, he's published three volumes. I think if anybody wanted to read one volume, and it was published by W.W. Norton, so it was both for specialists and for general readers, his book, The Bolsheviks Come to Power, is really the best thing we have. Okay. Having said that, let me define the word Bolshevik so we know what we're talking about.
Thank you.
Lenin's party, later, considerably later, known as the Russian Communist Party and then the Soviet Communist Party, grew out of the German Social Democratic movement of the early 19th century. That was the movement that particularly took root in Germany, but it was the Marxist parties and movements that had grown out of the writings of Marx and Engels. And it was the beginning of what we call social democracy. A wing of that movement became very radical and revolutionary. A wing of it became the social democratic parties, that were evolutionary, democratic, and governed many countries in the 20th century. Germany, Sweden, Scandinavian countries. In fact, today, the German Social Democratic Party, the SPD, which grows out of this Marxist movement of the late 19th century, is the strong coalition partner of Merkel's party, which governs Germany today. And it is being said in Germany today that Merkel's leadership is in deep crisis due to the Greek crisis, due to the refugee crisis, due to the Ukrainian crisis. And if she falls, the German Social Democratic Party may come to power. It was the party of Willy Brandt, as some of our older readers remember. So European social democracy, which is roughly what Bernie Sanders has in mind when he calls himself a democratic socialist, is a European tradition that is roughly akin to what the late Paul Wellstone called the democratic wing of the Democratic Party, the left wing of our Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. I actually think that Bernie would have done better when he was asked to explain his democratic socialism, would have been to say that in the 20th century, welfare states emerged in capitalist systems, compassionate ones, to help those people who couldn't cope with the dynamics of capitalism and create social justice. And the Social Democratic Party, this is long-winded, but it's all part of the story, the Social Democratic Party really became the democratic welfare state party of Europe. And there's nothing bad to say about them.
Yeah, FDR picked up that mantle here, didn't he?
Right, and they were closely related to the trade union movement. And in a kind of distant way, the Labour Party of England was part of that movement. So, but the word Bolshevik is very important. What happened was, is this Russian Social Democratic Party, which formed just before the turn of the 20th century in Russia, where it was completely illegal because the Tsarist system was repressive and censorious. It split at a conference in the early 20th century, because there was a debate of the party, should the party be an open party, trying to operate democratically in anti-democratic Tsarist Russia, announcing its meetings, having an open enrollment of members, participating in elections that didn't exist. That is, trying to emulate the more advanced democratization that occurred in Europe and in Germany. Or, and this was according to Lenin, who is now a rising figure, younger figure in the party, must it be essentially an underground party composed only, as Lenin put it, of professional revolutionaries, meaning people who could go underground, who would not have to hold permanent jobs in the labor movement or elsewhere. And if they did go underground, the party would take care of their families. They would have false identity cards. And Lenin said you had to have this because you had to fight fire with fire.
Fascinating. We've got to take a quick break here. We're talking with Professor Stephen Cohen, professor emeritus of Russian studies and politics at NYU and Princeton. He writes for thenation.com and his book, Bukharin. Am I saying that right?
That's right, Bukharin.
Bukharin and the Bolshevik Revolution.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
As well as his more recent book, Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, which examines the new Cold War. Both are available in paperback right now. We'll be back with Professor Cohen. And welcome back. So, Professor Cohen, you were saying.
So, to finish the history, or at least the prehistory, there was abroad, naturally, because the party couldn't actually meet in Russia, there was a convention, a Congress of the Russian Social Democratic Party. I think it was 1902, and or shortly thereafter. And this issue was voted on. What kind of party? Now, Lenin had written his famous little book, What Is to Be Done, calling for a small, professional, conspiratorial underground party, because he said that we can't have a public party in Russia. It would be repressed quickly by the Tsarist authorities. If you announce everybody interested come to the meeting of the Russian Social Democratic Party at Moscow University at 7 o'clock tonight, everybody would be arrested. So Lenin said, no, you needed this party of professional revolutionaries. Others said, no, we have to be democratic and open. And they had a vote. And it turned out that a couple people had to go to the bathroom. So Lenin won and was in the majority. And the word in Russian for majority is bolshevstvo, Bolsheviks for short. And the word in Russian for the minority is menshevstvo, or the Mensheviks. So henceforth, Lenin had a piece of good luck. He got to call his party the majoritist, the Bolsheviks. And the more social democratic oriented, more democratic wing of the Russian Social Democratic Party was stuck with the label the Mensheviks, the minorities. And that went down in history. And in fact, after that, Lenin called his party until after the revolution in 1917, the Russian Social Democratic Party, parentheses, the Bolsheviks, because everybody wants to be with the majority, of course. It was great advertisement, but it stuck.
Is there any kind of a parallel between that and how SDS, you know, the Weather Underground split off from SDS, and if the Weather Underground had taken over SDS, they might have been a... I don't know. Maybe not. It just reminds me of some of the meetings I went to in the 60s where people were going, we got to go underground. You know, they're trying to kill us, all this kind of stuff. Back to you.
Well, I was teaching at Columbia as a young graduate assistant in 1968. And you remember that Columbia had what it thought was a revolution. And the campus was closed and the police came and the buildings were occupied.
Yep, same thing happened in MSU.
Right. And there was a famous American literary social critic named Dwight MacDonald who covered all this. And I remember when he came on campus and the wing of the student movement, as you say, SDS and the others, had split. One occupied one building and the other building. And Dwight pointed to the building of the radical SDS people. And he says, gentlemen, there sit the Bolsheviks. And he pointed to his right and he said, there sit the Mensheviks. So the memory of this formation of the Communist Party was alive in the generation that preceded me because it had deeply influenced them. And you point to what is, if not a law, a general tendency, that movements for change, and this happened, by the way, in the civil rights movement in America. I grew up in Kentucky. I remember it very, very well. Where one group presses for far more radical action. In the case of SDS, it could have been even with violence, and another is devoted to the evolutionary democratic. So what happened in Russia wasn't unusual, but it was fateful when the revolution itself came in 1917.
Remarkable. We'll be back with Professor Stephen Cohen right after this. Welcome back. We're talking with Professor Stephen Cohen, Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies and Politics at NYU in Princeton, author of Bukharin, The End of Bolshevik Revolution, and Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, both available in paperback, and he writes for TheNation.com. And just to summarize very quickly, and please correct me if I get anything wrong, the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks, these are basically just Russian words for the majority and the minority. And in a meeting that when a bunch of people had to go to the bathroom, Lenin took over this meeting and basically became the Bolshevik Party. The Russian Communist Party became the and Bolshevik simply means we're the majority party. So, right?
One correction. Until the revolution in 1917, though the outbreak of World War One did a lot to solidify these two wings of the Russian Social Russian Marxist Party into separate parties, because Lenin's wing of the party was against the war, considered it an imperialist war. The Mensheviks, like the Social Democrats in Europe, took a more patriotic position and even participated in Germany, for example, in the war ministries of their governments. And that violated, according to Lenin, the Marx's axiom that the working class has no homeland. It's at war with the bourgeoisie. But the important thing, Tom, is that when the Tsar fell in February 1917, in effect, the Bolshevik wing of the Russian Social Democratic Party and the Menshevik, the majority and minority wing, became two separate parties with their own leaders, their own central committee, their own headquarters, their own tactics, their own membership. Trotsky, who would later join Lenin's that year in 1917, did as he often did in his career, try to establish some middle position. But there was no middle. When revolutions come, the center or the middle disappear. And Trotsky joined Lenin, and the rest, as they say, is history. He and Lenin led the party primarily, though with others, including the man I wrote about, Nikolai Bukharin, during the revolution, the Civil War. Now, the point here is, if we want to identify the Bolsheviks, Lenin's party, in history, which later became the Soviet Communist Party, we should not abuse the word revolution. We talk about the Cultural Revolution, Sexual Revolution, and the Gay Revolution, and revolution, including times we call revolutions. Revolution has a meaning in history to historians and sociologists, political scientists. Revolution is an enormous upheaval from below when a great mass of people suddenly enter history and tear down the old order. There have been certainly three in history that we focus on, the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, and the Chinese Revolution. And they're often accompanied, but not always, by civil wars. There is a debate, for example, about whether the founding of our nation was really a revolution, or was it an elite in the colonies ousting the occupying imperial elite of Britain? If so, that would not be a revolution. But the Revolutionary War did become a revolutionary phenomenon. The second point is, there's a mythology about Lenin's party, the Bolsheviks, and the 1917 revolution. And the mythology is that 1917, from the fall of the Tsar to the moment when the Bolsheviks came to power in October, was really a kind of organized, controlled upheaval run by a tightly disciplined party of Lenin's Bolsheviks. And that's completely false. The reality is that 1917 was a quintessential revolution from below. There were three revolutions that destroyed the Tsarist order in 1917 and opened the door to Lenin's Communist Party. One was a revolution in the army, because World War I had taken a terrible toll in the trenches on Russian soldiers, and they literally began to, as Lenin said, stick their bayonets through their officers, take their guns, and go home to the villages where they burned down the landlord's manor house and seized the land. That was the second revolution, an agrarian revolution where the descendants of serfs, which in serfdom had been abolished only in the late 19th century, the peasants had not been given real land. They were in arrears to the landlord. They worked basically as hired hands. They seized the land. And there was a third revolution in industrial Russia, in the factories, which the Bolsheviks called the working class revolution, which began to seize the factories under the slogan workers' control. Those three revolutions in the army, on the land, and in the factories utterly destroyed the old Tsarist 400-year Romanov order. There were elections. There was an epidemic of elections, democratic level elections in 1917. To official governmental bodies, because there was a provisional government, but also to what was called the Soviets. And remarkably, Lenin's party won majorities in many of these elections, not only in the Soviet, to the Soviets, which were left-wing bodies, but also to municipal governments. So that when Lenin, in the middle of 1917, issued the slogan, "All power to the Soviets, down with the provisional government," he had in mind turning Russia into a revolutionary republic with a government formed by these Soviets, which at that time were elected democratically, and in which, in both Moscow and St. Petersburg, the Bolsheviks, Lenin's party, had, through democratic means, gotten a majority. Now, it later became a dictatorship, but that's the prehistory, that the Bolsheviks were not very organized. They were abuse. And many people feel, including Rabinowitz in his book, The Bolsheviks Take to Power, Come to Power, that made them more attuned to revolutionary opinion in the streets and in the land. The final word about this, there was one Democratic, but 82% of the population couldn't read or write, so it's not clear how much information people had. It took 3 or 4 months to do the balloting in this vast country. There was one revolution for a constituent assembly. At the end of 1917, the Bolsheviks got 25%. The peasant party got 52%. It was a peasant country. But 25% gotten by a small, what had been a small urban party, Lenin's Bolsheviks, was a lot. So then began the Civil War, and then began Soviets.
We'll pick that up right after the break. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
It's Guy Fawkes Day, and Ted Cruz talking about Bolsheviks and Mensheviks in the Democratic Party. We're talking to the guy who probably taught him that, Professor Stephen Cohen. Written paperback. Alternatives, which examines the new Cold War. He also writes for TheNation.com. Professor Cohen, so we're up to the revolution happening, right?
We're going
to
move fast now.
Okay.
But I ought to say that I have several crosses to bear. David Petraeus came to Princeton when I was teaching a course on Soviet foreign policy to the Woodrow Wilson School, I think either to get his PhD on one of those mid-career military programs when they go off to a university. And he was in my seminar on Soviet affairs. That didn't work out too well either. So I have a lot of crosses.
You're going to be burning this karma off for lifetimes to come, Professor.
So, okay. So we've kind of explained that the Bolsheviks were the radical wing of the Russian Marxist Party and the Mensheviks, the moderate wing, and they became two-party. After the Civil War, in 1921, Lenin essentially said to the Mensheviks, and remember, this was like a divided family. They now had a lot of animosity and were accusing each other of all sorts of mortal sins. But they had known each other for years. They'd all suffered under the Tsar in exile or in Tsarist prison. Lenin essentially said to the Mensheviks, you can stay in the new revolutionary Soviet Russia and work in the ministries. Many of them were experts, highly intellectual, and help us rebuild a new Russia, or go abroad. And many immigrated. And in fact, when I came to New York as a graduate student in the 1960s, quite a few eminent, but now elderly, Mensheviks lived on the Upper West Side of Manhattan around Columbia University and used to come to the Russia-related events at Columbia. They also published in a very good magazine, left-wing labor magazine, that existed at that time, I don't know if you know it, Tom, called The New Leader. It may exist online now, but it was a magazine basically of social democracy with a major focus on Russia, and the Menshevik historians had a lot to say, and we learned a lot from them. But thereafter, apart from the Mensheviks in exile, their fate in Russia became horrible because almost all of the ones who stayed in Russia and their families, because Stalin was an equal opportunity genocidal murderer, died in the Great Terror of the late 1930s. Now, that raises a question related to Bolshevism or Leninism. I wrote an article about this many years ago called Bolshevism and Stalinism, where I took the position that, in fact, Bolshevism-Leninism was a phenomenon very different from Stalinism. That, yes, Stalinism grew out of Leninism and its practices and its ideas, but it became something different. For example, the terror of the Bolshevik Party during the Civil War was fairly typical Civil War terror, the kind of thing you see in Civil War. The terror that Stalin unleashed on the country in the late 1930s was something completely different. There was no Civil War. It was just a murderous purge of the nation. Millions of people swept away, including the old Bolshevik Party. That the old Bolshevik Party and its founding fathers, with the exception of Lenin, who had died too early to be killed by Stalin, and Stalin himself, were killed by Stalin, which raised a question. Had something new emerged out of the Leninist Party, Stalinism? That debate goes on in Russia today. And why? Because your timing is only off by about a year and a half. 1917 will mark the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. I was in Moscow last week for the opening of the museum devoted to the victims of Stalin's terror, the history of the Gulag, and also the unveiling of the design of a monument that Putin, yes, Putin, has decreed. It's in the center of Moscow, devoted to the memory of Stalin's victims. So Russia, the intellectual community, the historical community, and the government, of course, because it gets involved in these things, is gearing up for countless conferences and radio talk shows and documentary films. And this is going to be a big issue in schools, in the, not elementary school, but in middle schools, high schools and colleges, about was the Russian Revolution, and this is the way the Russians frame it, a tragedy or a progressive leap for Russia? Now, of course, under the Soviet regime, it was regarded as a progressive leap with some tragedy on the sidelines. Many people in Russia since that time have come to see it only as a tragedy that severed Russia from its more glorious or evolutionary path represented by Tsarism. But this debate's going to obsess the nation, at least the political, intellectual part of the nation, beginning in a few months, because you got to get started for these big anniversaries. The 100th is a big, one of the biggest. And one of the questions is going to be just what we've been discussing. What was the role of Lenin's Bolsheviks in the revolution? Was it progressive or was it destructive to the nation? Was Stalin, which he's the most, in historical polls today, he's the most admired modern political figure, historical figure in Russia today for various reasons. Was Stalin a great hero, or was he a man who destroyed Russia and its people and its future? And if so, responsible for Stalin? Or did Stalin kill the Leninist movement? All these things, which Western historians have debated for years, there's no consensus, are going to be debated in Russia. So your timing is only off maybe 5 or 6 months before this begins.
It's going to be fascinating.
These are what Russians call Zhivaya Historia, living history, because they shape the nation.
Right.
It's rather akin, though I don't like historical analogies that aren't precise, it's rather akin to our ongoing debate about the role of slavery and Jim Crow South in American history.
I was just going to ask you that. Is the genocide of Native Americans and the Holocaust of African Americans in the United States, it's been largely written out of our textbooks, or at least sanitized, certainly for people of our generation. I mean, there's big debates now, what's going to. And I was wondering if the Russians were essentially sanitizing the Stalinist era. Apparently not.
Well, the answer is yes and no, because some Russians, including the Russian Communist Party, are glorifying Stalin and deleting the horrors of Stalinism. Mm-hmm. But the problem with Stalinism is that when people look back, and indeed people who survived it, metaphorically speaking, they see two towering mountains of the Stalin era, a mountain of achievement when the country was industrialized, through industrialization, modernization, transformed from a country of 82% peasants, couldn't read or write, into a substantially urban, literate, educated country. When Russia prepared itself to defeat Nazi Germany, and after that became the other great atomic or nuclear superpower in the world. And you can't delete Stalin from history any more than you can delete the fact that most of our founding fathers were slave owners.
Right.
And by the way, I'm older than you, Tom, but they did not teach us in that segregated school system down in Kentucky when I was in lower and middle school that fact that the people we called the fathers of American democracy owned slaves. We only learned that later. And we're still debating. I mean, is Jefferson a great Democrat? And if he is, can a great Democrat be a slave owner? I mean, and Washington, too. I mean, it's now the answer most people give is they were people of their times, and we shouldn't judge them harshly because such were the times. But you could say that about the Bolsheviks. In the aftermath of the, up until then, the worst war ever, World War I, brutalizing, that the Bolsheviks were affected by the horrors that had been sweeping Europe for 4 years. And they performed their own brutalities, partly as a result of that. So do we say they did terrible things, but it's okay because they were people of their times? I was interviewed by this in Moscow last week by not by a Russian newspaper, but by the Moscow Times, which is an English language paper for Westerners living in Russia and owned primarily, though this is going to change because of the law, by a foreign company. That did I think Russia had done well in acknowledging its Stalinist past and its victims? And I said that it was hard for me to judge because I had come to Moscow for the opening of a national Museum of the History of the Gulag. That is a museum devoted to Stalin's victims. There is, so far as I know, and I do know, there is no museum in the United States devoted to the history of American slavery.
There will be one opening here in Washington, D.C. next year.
Well, there's been talk of one, and I forget his name.
This is the Museum of African American History. It's going to be part of the Smithsonian. And I guess it's not devoted to slavery.
I know about that. It's not the second. But I'm talking about a memorial of repentance where people come, the horror of it all, which becomes a research center and regularly puts on events, memorializes.
Sort of like Yad Vashem.
That's right. And the museum that opened in Moscow, with the backing of the Putin government, I mean, we can demonize Putin all we want, but this is a much more complicated man than we learned from the New York Times and the Washington Post, that it costs a lot of money. And a lot of his supporters worship Stalin and don't like the fact that he's done this. But if I ended the interview, by the way, RT did an interview with me also, because I've been involved in the history of this museum in Russia. And what I said at the end is we ought to have a competition with Russia, not who can build more weapons, but who can achieve historical justice more quickly. At the moment, Russia may be slightly ahead on the future.
Fascinating. We're talking with Professor Stephen Cohen. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
His books, Bukharin and the Bolshevik Revolution, and Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, both available in paperback right now. He writes for TheNation.com.
Well, I mean, when we look at the world around us, and again, we're spinning now out of Leninism or Bolshevism and what was its role in Russia and whether Stalinism destroyed it or was its natural consequence, it comes into our daily lives. Now, I'm older than you, Tom. I knew people who were the children of the victims of Stalin. I wrote a book called The Victim's Return, which treated the children as well. Some rose very high in the Communist Party. Some grew up in orphanages, remained bitter. Many became dissidents. So today we're talking more about the grandchildren. I mean, now, if we look at President Obama, obviously, his election as the first black American president was a kind of act of repentance and historical justice for what happened to black folks during slavery. But there are many people, black people, who are descendants of slaves, I mean, grandchildren even, who are in prominent positions in American life. This is true also in regard to Stalin's victims in Russia. For example, Gorbachev, whom all of your viewers will remember as the man who tried to democratize Russia. His wife's father was shot during the Stalinist terror. Calculated no less than at least five members of the top Gorbachev leadership who were the children or grandchildren of people who had been shot under Stalin. Even more so, I can't mention his name. It was very interesting. But we met, my wife and I, Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor of The Nation, when we were in Moscow last week, a very high aide to President Putin. And we were chatting about the opening of this museum, which he supported, though he's known as a very tough guy, no friend of liberalization. And it turned out that both of his grandparents, let me repeat that, this man must be about 52, both of his grandparents had been shot or sent to the Gulag, the concentration camps under Stalin. But here's the thing. One grandparent was a priest, and the other was a Red Army officer. So that shows you that the victims of Stalinism knew no demographic limits, and their grandchildren now are in charge of Russia. But they have different attitudes. They draw different lessons from that past, as do many black folks in America, some much more radical. For example, there's this movement in America toward, reparations. Yeah, and I don't know how much traction it's gotten, where other black folks, and I know a bit about this because for 30 years I've been involved in basketball tournaments in the local inner city outdoor courts here. Almost all black kids with not a brilliant future awaiting them, alas. But I hear these conversations, and some people think it's silly that too much time has passed and that black folks should just get on with moving into the middle class as best they can. So you have the ancestors of these victims have different attitudes. And that's, by the way, also true of people who were the survivors or the ancestors of people who died or survived the Jewish Holocaust in Germany. So the world, I mean, it's a comparative phenomenon, and I am not quick to judge Russia about how it is judged its Stalinist past, because we bear our own faults in this country.
Yeah, very well said. Professor Stephen Cohen is with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back, 10 minutes before the hour. We're talking to Professor Stephen Cohen, the author of Bukharin and the Bolshevik Revolution, which is still in print, and paperback, and Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives. He writes for TheNation.com. Professor Cohen, you kind of jumped through something that I don't know what you're talking about. You said in 19, I think it was 21 or 25, the Russian Russian Civil War happened. And then you just kind of mentioned that and then went on from there. I know absolutely nothing about the Russian Civil War. How did that happen? Who were the parties?
The Civil War broke out about 6 months after Lenin's party took power at the end of 1917. And there's nothing surprising here. Revolutions polarize nations. There is nothing more polarizing than a civil war. It divides families, it divides towns, divides ethnic groups and religious groups. Many people try to run away from the civil war. If you've ever read Zhivago, for example, it's really the story of a man, a sensitive, poetic man, who wants no part of the Reds or the Whites, as the combatants in the civil war were known, and tries to escape. And he can't, because everywhere he finds the Civil War raging. The Civil War utterly polarized the nation. When it was over and the Bolsheviks had won, most of the people who fought for the Whites were forced to leave the country. They fled. They went to Paris. Hollywood made a lot of films about them in the 1930s and 40s. Some came to New York. I was amazed to learn, when I came to New York, that Kerensky, Alexander Kerensky, who was the head of the provisional government, which tried to govern Russia from the fall of the Tsar to the rise of the Bolsheviks, lived on Upper Fifth Avenue in New York and died here. So
who were the Reds were the communists. Who were the Whites?
Right. Well, the Whites were the anti-communists. I mean, and really, you know, there's a whole literature. Why did the Reds win? Because the Whites had some logistical advantages. They occupied the territories adjacent to the sea. So they had supply lines, and they were being supplied by the Western powers. I mean, Woodrow Wilson in particular was determined to overthrow the Bolshevik government. But the Reds won. In the end, I think, but it's not my expertise, and there may be scholars that say Cohen's full of it, he didn't know what he's talking about, but I have at least the educated impression that essentially it was a war for the soul of the peasantry. Now remember, the peasants made up 82% of the Russian population. You couldn't govern Russia unless the peasants were at least acquiescent in your rulership. Lenin issued a decree right after he came to power, decree number one, giving the land to the peasantry. Whatever land you occupy and formerly had been leased from or owned by the landlords is now yours. But he adopted the old populist peasant program that the land came from God, and therefore you couldn't buy or sell it. You could pass it on to your children. Under Russian law at that time, only to male children, to your sons, not daughters. But what this ended up being were tiny little, not very productive plots. But I would say that the reason the Bolsheviks won the Civil War is though the particularly liked the Bolsheviks, they hated and feared more the return of the Tsarist government, which was the White Army, which would take the land away from them. So in the end, I think it was the land question. And because it would make it easier for the Bolsheviks to recruit soldiers from the peasantry, made the peasantry more willing to supply the Red Army. That's my judgment. I mean, undoubtedly there are other factors. Now, Stalin, and here's the bitter irony, and everybody should remember this, when Stalin imposed collectivization on the Russian peasantry after defeating the guy I wrote a book about, Nikolai Bukharin, because he had opposed forced collectivization. When Stalin imposed collectivization on the country, essentially he took the land away from the peasantry. So you could say that Lenin, in 1917, by law, gave the peasantry their tiny plots, and Stalin, by the force of the state, took it away from them by forcing all the peasantry into collective or state farms. And the peasantry entered, some people would say, a new era of serfdom. They had almost no power. They didn't even have internal passports. They couldn't leave the land. That came only under, was it Khrushchev or Brezhnev? I forget. But they had to deliver their produce to the state at fixed prices. Now, other people say that's how Stalin industrialized the nation, that he needed the resources from the peasant sector to feed an industrial population and to export for technology. So there's a bunch of arguments here.
Yeah. Well, that argument is made about slavery in the United States. Without slavery, the South would not have been built.
Well, the American economy was built originally on the economy of the South, on the cotton plantations.
Right.
And that was based on slavery, of course. The point here, though, is that the fate of the peasantry got reversed under Stalin. And even today, by the way, Tom, in Russia, privatization of land is now legal. And agriculture is doing much better in Russia now, particularly with the sanctions that have been imposed by Europe. Russia was importing about 70% of its food when the Ukrainian crisis began. That's way too much. No country should produce something that's more expensive at home than it is to import. But 70% importation of food for an agricultural country as big as Russia is too much. That happened in the 1990s. So the sanctions, through Putin's policy of so-called import substitution, is trying to revitalize his agriculture. For example, Russians fell in love with foreign cheese. So now you've got Russian cheesemakers trying to emulate all the cheese that was imported from France and Italy and the rest. And I was in the shops. I looked at it. It all tastes the same to me. I don't have a sense of, I mean, I can't tell French cheese from American cheese from Russian. It seemed fine to me. There's one other question before we leave.
We just hit the end of the hour. I'm
all
sorry.
Right. Well, why is there no Social Democratic Party in Russia today? We can talk about that another day.
We will. And I thank you so much for being with me this hour, Professor Cohen. It's great talking with you as always. Thank you, sir. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It does require all of us to participate. Get out there, get active, tag, you're in. And check out Professor Cohen's work in thenation.com. And also his books, Bukharin and the Bolshevik Revolution, and Soviet Face and Lost Alternatives, both available in paperback. We'll be back tomorrow. See you then. Thank you.
Oh, my, everybody. I hope you got all that. I'm thinking I'll stay up the night and transcribe that. It's too good. I don't know. I'll see what I can do. But I think that the thing that he did was he took us down the road with pretty much an enlightening fact that the Russian people have examined their history and actually worked with it. And Putin actually, took it to the point of a memorial, a library and a memorial of forgiveness for what had been done and honoring the people who lost their lives in the process of becoming a nation. And we have a little more of that to do over here, I would think. Is that you, Marita? I heard a little bit there. Did you want to say anything?
No, your timing worked out perfect for playing this tonight, didn't it?
Well, I think there's a synchronicity that we all have together, don't we?
I don't know. I don't have anything special to say. Just happy that everybody's been here, and we'll see them again next week. But you finish whatever you want to do.
Okay. I was just going to refer to a sister of ours sent us two more of Robert Vavra's books. And this is just a little introduction to
the sect unicorn books. It's called The Unicorn of Kilimanjaro. And I wanted just to read those. We got just enough time to do that. And then, it says here, in the international bestseller Unicorns I Have Known, Robert Vavra brought us magical photographs of the rare and noble creature that has fascinated men from Plato to Picasso, translated into a range of languages from German to Japanese. The book was also an evocative description of unicorn social behavior and lore. Now Robert Vavra takes us with him to East Africa, not only in search of single-horned creature, rather also in quest of the dark continent of his childhood dreams. The adventure starts at Mount Kilimanjaro, where Vavra's friend Ernest Hemingway said a unicorn was sure to be found. It proceeds with a series of hair-raising encounters with African big game, which the author, using a long-lost formula, is able to approach without the slightest danger to his person. Finally, taking us on a foot safari to the world's last virgin forest and into the secretive world of the Maasai, Vavra encounters the unicorn and treats the reader to photographs of unicorn display rituals never before recorded on film. Robert Vavra's 1987 Elm Tree Unicorn Expedition Diary, accompanied by the exquisite drawings of Lee Mitchelson, is reproduced here in its entirety. The photographs of the East African landscape, the people, the animals, are as fascinating as the subject matter. Yet more than anything, this book is a plea for conservation, a warning that as man continues to destroy animals and their habitats at the present rate, creatures as common to us as the elephant, the lion, the giraffe, may one day be as rare and difficult to find as the unicorn. And we've already reached that. Both the lion and the elephant are an endangered species, along with the rhinoceros. I haven't heard much about giraffes, but I'd probably say probably the same thing. So we are in the epic turnaround point, and let's just know that we are all in a unity consciousness. We are all another ourselves. And let's meet here again tomorrow, same time, same place. And blessings to all. Nasara now, see you in your dreams. And music maestro, namaste.
Good night, all.